Log Talk Radio.
Whoa. We got all kinds of stuff going on today. This is going to be a really fun show. First of all, I'd like to welcome to the show Frank Burleson, who is, not Frank Burleson. He'll be coming on at 11 a.m. Pacific. But first of all, I'd like to the other guest. We're going to be talking Frank, and I will be talking about the UW's trip to L.A., UW and Wazoo's trip to L.A., and also just other things going on in the Pac-12. Some other college basketball stuff. He's very qualified to talk on those topics. And then we've got Amar Abdul Nazir coming on to talk about Seattle U, and that's going to be fun because they're getting ready to start conference play. They just had a really big, very, very good-looking win over Cal Riverside Highlanders there at the Connolly Center, and now they're getting ready to play Grand Canyon at the Key Arena. Grand Canyon team, by the way, who just barely lost to a very good Illinois team by 4 points. So Grand Canyon almost beat Illinois. New Mexico State got to the finals of the Diamond Head Classic over there in Hawaii and nearly beat a USC team that's obviously got quite a bit of talent. So there's some real talent in the WAC. And am I talking to Amar?
Yeah, I'm here.
Great. I just was starting with two items. First of all, Grand Canyon nearly beat Illinois, and of course New Mexico State played neck and neck with USC. Was beaten by a very good USC team that unfortunately had a down game the next game against UW and lost to UW at home there. But I think has got a ton of talent, and probably if they got D'Anthony Melton, if it weren't for the scandal, of course that's a whole different topic. But they would probably be even better. And as it is, they're going to be a strong team, I believe, as the year rolls on in the Pac-12. But there's some real talented teams in this WAC. What are you thinking about the WAC right now?
I think there is some talent in the conference. Things are kind of so far. I mean, conference play hasn't gotten started yet, but as far as in the non-conference play, things are kind of working out how they were predicted in the preseason. As far as what teams are at the top and what teams are at the bottom. So far everything's kind of going according to what people thought. I'd say the only real surprise is Cal State Bakersfield. They were kind of predicted to be like a top three team. They won the conference mm-hmm. a couple years ago, but they are currently under 500, just at 7-8 overall.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But other than that, I mean, they played, Arizona, they've played UCLA, they've played Arkansas. So, I mean, they've played some really good teams. They were expected to be, right up there with the best teams in the conference. So far, the top three, New Mexico State, Utah Valley, and Grand Canyon, they were all expected to be pretty good. And then Seattle U is in fourth place at 11-6.
Right. Yeah. And Seattle U was expected to be fifth place. Now they're in fourth place as far as their non-conference record. There's some teams above them that look good. Grand Canyon, obviously, New Mexico State, obviously. Utah Valley has had some good moments. I'm probably a little less impressed by them, but than New Mexico State and Grand Canyon. But the key thing is, they have had some good moments. I mean, they lost to Kentucky on the road by 10, which is pretty impressive, actually, when all said and done. They beat a number of teams, they other than that first game, which is kind of a surpriser, they really haven't had that kind of a year. They lost to Hawaii on the road over in Hawaii by one, but Again, that's, you know, that's not really that impressive of an outcome.
Yeah.
They haven't really done that much. But I, to be honest with you, I think Seattle U's got enough going, and I think Jim has got a system in kind of moving in the right direction with his traditional system of a lot of 3-point shooting. Where I think a lot can happen for this team. To be honest with you, I would not at all be surprised if they, just because Jim has been so good over the years at Eastern Washington at winning close games, I would not be surprised if they were one of the top two or three teams. And I don't know that they're going to win the conference, but if they can get into the finals of the tournament, you know, and get a close game with whoever's the number one seed or something like that, they might possibly do it, which I think would be incredible for his first year. What's your take on what he's done so far?
Well, just before I start with that, I do have to give Utah Valley props. They played Kentucky and Duke on back-to-back days, so that's just like I can't remember any team doing anything like that outside of like a conference tournament, you know. So I mean, you know, they lost to Kentucky by 10, they lost to Duke by 30. Still, that's like, you know, that's incredible.
Right.
But so yeah,
give them credit for that.
So with Seattle U, I like what they're doing so far. You know, I like what Hayford's doing. I think that, you know, they brought in, you know, some of these graduate transfers who were ready to contribute right away, you know, as opposed to, you know, you're starting over, you're rebuilding, and you bring in a lot of freshmen, and, you have to get them all acclimated and everything. But, I mean, they're bringing in these guys who are experienced, who are, you know, 22, 23 years old, who have played for big-time programs. You know, I mean, Jordan Hill played at Wisconsin. He was in the tournament last year. You know, Rashad Gittins. Like these guys, they played at, like, you know, big programs, and so they've been there before. And they're right now they're all contributing. They're all, the three, they're all starting. Gittins, Jordan Hill, and then Josh Herlihy. He was the one that I wasn't sure if he was going to be a starter this year, but he's worked his way into the starting lineup. And actually, he just won WAC Player of the Week.
That's right.
I think that was announced today, yeah. So, they're doing good. I mean, you know, the guys who you expected to do well, like Matei Kavis, he's their leading scorer. He was, you know, going into the season, he was seen as their best returning player. He's averaging, 17.8 points a game, 5 rebounds, shooting over 50% from the field, shooting 50% from three. So, I mean, he's doing really well. Aaron Menzies, he's numbers aren't, like, amazing, just, you know, for his size. I mean, you know, I think he's about 12 points, about 7 rebounds a game, about 2 blocks.
Yeah.
I mean, for a guy that's, you know, 7'3", it's like he's had some – dominant moments, but then he's also had some games where it's like you look at the stat line, you're like, you know, how did he only get, you know, 3 rebounds? You know, like, you know, how did he,
right? Yeah,
you know, shoot, you know, how did he shoot, you know, 2 for 10 or whatever? Like, so I mean, there's kind of a consistency issue there, but he produces, you know. Like he had a 32-point, 15 rebound game against PLU. He had, you know, a number of double digit rebound games. He's had some double doubles, like a 2014 game against Nichols. But yeah, I mean, you know, going into conference play, they kind of have like the, you know, both extremes of the conference right away. Their first conference game is against Grand Canyon on Saturday, and then their next one is against Chicago State, who's like the worst team in the conference. So, the first two games is like, okay, you're going to see, okay, have a stack up against the best team in the league, and have a stack up against the worst team in the league. So,
yeah, and that's kind of interesting too. You know, I think that we'll be interested to see what the consistency factor is with Seattle U. I think that they have just as I think Jim gets accustomed to his players and his players get accustomed to his system. I think there's been a couple of hiccups as opposed to a team that's a complete yo-yo that goes up and down and up and down. They just have had like, and this is really, and this is fairly normal for any basketball team at any level, regardless. They have like a good run, and then all of a sudden they just do something that just makes no sense. They just kind of have a complete kind of hiccup. But they've had those kind of surreptitiously. It hasn't been like every other game where it's bad game, good game. It's been like, you know, run of 5-6 really decent outings and then one bad one, you know. So, but yeah, regarding Menzies, you know, 32 blocks is also a good stat too. He's a guy. He's the one guy they can count to protect the rim. The next highest shot blocker on the team is Jordan Hill, you know. So I mean, so he's basically the only guy that really can protect the rim. So you got to look at him, you know, in the context of a WAC as being really valuable, just to be able to have that additional thing to add to the team. Dynamic, and he is a redshirt junior, so he'll be back again next year, and you know, that's something to build around when you consider that next year, you know, these guys are going to start looking a lot bigger and tougher in the paint. I mean, they've got, you know, Miles Carter, the transfer from Seton Hall, 6'9", 230. He'll be in there next year. He'll be a junior, a fourth year junior, and they'll also have a couple other guys that are, you know, bigger guys that are, you know, good at, well, there's, well, not, he's really the only other big to add to it, but they'll be, you know, as, you know, as guys get bigger, you know, I think, you know, I think that, I mean, as the team evolves, I think they're going to look a little bit bigger and more imposing in the post. I mean, Scott Olenale get a year older. He's a pretty big kid. And then, you know, I think, well, their recruiting's been, has been really good with this Trayvon Hopkins guy coming. He's a guard, obviously, but I don't think they're going to lose a lot. They've got some really interesting players coming in and next year. And, you know, I think the program's on the rise for sure. You know, the guy from SMU, the transfer from SMU has got to help them too. What's the latest on those guys sitting out from the off season? Anything new on any of those guys?
Yeah, I mean, I haven't heard anything new as far as, you know, they're all still around. I don't think any one of them are injured or anything. So yeah, everything's on track for them to, you know, be able to come in next season and contribute. Deshaun McDowell is the one you're talking about from SMU.
SMU, yeah.
Yeah, he's going to be like a wing player. You know, he'll be, you know, hopefully able to kind of step in and give them what they're getting from Rashad Gittins right now. Because, you know, since he's going to be gone. You know, Hill's going to be gone. He's kind of become the starting point guard, you know, leading the team in assists, second in scoring.
Right.
He's tied to the lead in steals. So, Morton Means, who, you know, the true sophomore, he was with the team last year. Began as a starting point guard. So I'm thinking that, you know, after Hill's gone, it'll be Means will be kind of in the driver's seat for that job. Unless Aaron Nettles, who he's a freshman right now from Seattle Prep.
Right.
Unless, you know, he can maybe leapfrog him or when Hopkins comes in. I mean, he's kind of billed as like a combo guard. To me, when I've watched his highlights and stuff, he seems more like a shooting guard, but you know, he might have, you know, some point guard skills. And so maybe he's the guy to play point. I'm not sure.
They'll have some guards, McDowell and Hopkins and Means and Nettles. And, I mean, it's actually a good looking group. I mean, I think Nettles deserves some discussion here too. I mean the guy's he's averaging about 10 minutes per game to 11 minutes per game, but he's scoring right now. He's at 4 points a game, if his role increases up to more towards 20 with Hill not there, you know, you can probably count on him. And his ability to take care of the ball has over time has been good. This year, he hasn't had the best year, but it hasn't been horrible either. I mean, he's got eight assists and six turnovers, which is not great, but I mean, I think overall, I've seen him in the past as a pretty good ball control guy. I think with more time, I think he's going to be fine. Again, with Means you know, both those guys coming back with experience, and I think they'll be in good shape. And then you figure Hopkins, and then the other guy that ripped Ekholm, whatever he is, how he pronounces his name, from Southern California, from Santa Monica, California, he's apparently really blown up down California. I've been talking to people that have been watching him, and he's just turning out to be a heck of a shooter. So he, even with that height, he could be a real weapon too to go with some of these other guys. And I think they're going to need that. I mean, obviously they've got Kavis, but to have like another guy that can be that deadly, you know, alongside, or two of guys like that, with the way that Jim likes to space things out and stuff, that'll be really helpful too. So I think things are going in a really good direction. What do you think about this? What's your gut feeling about this WAC race?
Just one quick thing about Nettles. I mean, the one game that he played a lot, when they played PLU, he started. Him and Reigns were in the line together, and Hill missed that game. But Nettles, he had like 20 points, and he had 6 threes. So I mean, he can he can score, you know, and he can shoot. Given the opportunity. So yeah, I mean, he's, you know, I could see him, you know, getting that job next season, or at least being, you know, one of their top guys off the bench if he's not starting. So as far as the WAC race, I mean, I think it's gonna, you know, come down to the four. Well, I would say it would come down to New Mexico State, Grand Canyon. They're still the favorites, in my opinion.
Sure.
Seattle U is kind of on that next, you know, notch down. And I still think that Bakersfield is going to work their way back into it when conference play starts. I mean, they had, you know, a tough non-conference schedule, which I think explains the sub 500 record. But I think that, you know, they're going to get it together when the conference starts, and they're going to be right in the mix. So like you said, I mean, I think they can – Seattle U can be right there, you know, as far as when the conference tournament gets going. I mean, I could see them making the finals. And then once you're in the finals, I mean, you know, anything can happen there. So,
yeah.
You know, they've got –
Yeah, I think it's – go ahead. I'm sorry.
Oh, yeah, I was saying, like, you know, they've got the talent to – make a run like that. And I mean, it's kind of weird to say, because, you know, so much of the team is new, but they have experience, you know, and it's just a matter of getting their experienced guys to develop a chemistry and play well together. You know, they've got experience from different places, but, you know, they haven't been in CLU for 4 years, but, you know, they have experience from around the country, and now it's just a matter of bringing it together. And so far it's been working out well. You know, there was kind of, you know, coach was juggling some lineups around a little bit at the beginning of the season, and, you know, starting a guy one game, he wouldn't play that much the next game. And it seems like he's kind of settled in on a solid starting five these last few games. You know, the three grad transfers, and then Menzies at center, and Kavis in the lineup. And that's been working out pretty well for him. I mean, they've won, was it like 3 in a row now?
Yeah. I think so. Let me see. I'm not looking at the schedule right now, but that sounds about
3
right.
In a row. Five of their last 6. So
And that's a Pac-12 team. Exactly. And that's Cal team just beat Stanford too. So a lot of people thought that they were, you know, kind of a poor team, but, you know, when you're building around Marcus Lee, that grad transfer from Kentucky, or not grad transfer, but the transfer from Kentucky, senior transfer from Kentucky, and Kingsley Okoro, who's actually even blocking more shots than Marcus Lee, who's, you know, well-known as really talented. See, they got such power in the paint. You better be shooting from outside really well. And they just didn't have a very good night shooting the ball. That's like I said about the hiccups. You know, you get with a team like Seattle U, I mean, it's gonna, when you live and die by outside shooting, and, you know, you can be interpreted as that, you know, and you have a bad night, it's gonna be hard to win. But I mean, they've got some real talent, and, you know, I think they're gonna be placed up there in the top. And the key thing is, I think they have so much firepower on the right night. The right, you know, the right feel, they could do an awful lot. I think just night after night, they're going to be exciting. I think they're going to be competitive against everybody they play at home down at the Key Arena or Connolly Center. I think most of the games at the Key Arena from here on out.
I think so. Let me see. I got a check their schedule real quick.
Okay.
Yeah, the Chicago State game, which is Thursday on the 11th, that's at Connolly on campus.
Uh-huh.
But then they play Rio Grande Valley in mid-February at Connolly. But other than that, yeah, all the rest of their home games are going to be at Key Arena.
Yeah, most of them are going to be at Key Arena. And, you know, there's also the fact that a lot of their away games are on the WAC digital network. You can watch them on, you can stream them too. So they've got a pretty good situation to be able to watch this team this year, either at home in an arena where it's really easy to get a good seat, or on the net when they're on the road. So it's going to be a fun year to watch these guys, and they're just a fun team to watch, a fun team to root for. They got a lot going, and I think next year, like I said, with the transfers, and just really impressed. The thing that's actually most impressed me, really, of everything that Jim Hayford's done, there's been half a dozen major things he's done that have impressed me. One of them was being able to go out and get these three grad transfers. That's just really hard to do, and you know he was able to do that. And I'm just kind of wondering if he can do that on a regular basis while he builds his team. I mean, let's face it, that's how Oregon built their success. They really did. They, aside from just a variety of other things that went well for them and the fact that Dana Altman knows how to put together a program pretty well, they always seem to go out and get these grad transfers. I'll be at a much higher level of recruit than the ones that Jim Hayford's getting. But just to get grad transfers at all and to get them in large numbers and consistently every year is an amazing feat. And the fact he's been able to do that, if he can do it again this year, I mean, think how much better they could be. You know, they already look good with these transfers that they're sitting out and all the guys they're bringing in with the freshmen and the guys that are coming back. But imagine if he could pick up another one, two, or even three grad transfers. That could be really a big boost.
And they're the caliber of program, or I'd say like the kind of program that would, I think, be attractive to a lot of grad transfers, because you look at the guys that they have, like, you know, Hill and getting, it's like guys that either weren't playing a lot at big conference programs, you know, like in the Big Ten, you know, ACC, Big Ten, you know, Big East, guys like that, that weren't playing a lot, who you can be like, hey, if you come here, you know, you'll get the playing time that you weren't getting before.
Right.
I think that they're in a good position to be attractive to guys like that. And, or, you know, guys that, you know, maybe they were starting or playing a lot at kind of a mid-major, and okay, well, you can come here and you can, you know, be a starter too. You know, kind of like Mike Hurley, he was at Vermont and then comes here,
right,
you know, he's in the starting lineup. So yeah, I think they're in a good position to attract guys like that. So I think they can, you know, if they set their sights on grad transfers and they really want to target them, I think that, yeah, they should have, you know, some success bringing them in the next few years.
Well, this is something you can maybe speak to, but from what I know from just research that I've done with UW, it's very hard to get a grad transfer in over there because the grad schools are so hard to get into, because there's so much competition from all over the world to get into certain grad schools. And there's just not a lot of grad schools that are out there that are active at UW that aren't real competitive to get into. And so there's been sort of, I guess there's either been, it's like the chicken or the egg. There's either a concerted effort or some sort of unwritten rule about not letting football players and men basketball players into these grad programs just so they can play ball for a year, because it kind of downgrades the program, or it leaves a spot open, shut, that could attract a really high level student from elsewhere. And would take a very special student athlete to be able to get into a grad program at UW to get a grad transfer in, whereas other schools seem to get them. And I guess my understanding is private schools have some sort of an advantage, maybe, in that they are able to kind of move things around the way they want to, whereas there's a lot of pressure in the public schools that where it's more open, you know, open books, and, you know, there may be more public pressure to have a program, a grad program, let guys in like that. I'm just kind of wondering if you know anything about Seattle U's the way that they get grad transfers in to study. Do they, what type of level of what kind of bar do they have to get over to be able to get into Seattle U as a grad?
I don't know. I mean, I'm not sure what kind of bar they have to get over. I do, you know, just from my experience going to Seattle U and, you know, staying, you know, somewhat connected to things at the school afterwards, I have noticed a lot, not a lot. I've met quite a few people that went to grad school at SU that weren't what you'd call like traditional students. You know, maybe they were older, they hadn't been at school for a while. And so that to me says that that at Seattle U, yeah, it might be, I don't want to, you know, make a, you know, kind of sound like a downgrade program, but, you know, easier to get into grad school there than at.
Which is good.
Right, yeah, right. And,
yeah,
which is, I mean, good for, you know, anyone of us, you know, quote unquote, you know, regular people who, you know, like maybe want to go back to grad school. And good for, you know, these athletes who are trying to grad transfer. Because,
that's
yeah,
right.
The grad school isn't as competitive. Right. You know, there's not, you know, maybe at UW, I mean, yeah, there's a bunch of, you know, recently, you know, kids who had their undergrads who are now, you know, going to grad school the next year and it's really competitive to get into UW, but maybe at SU it's not as competitive. And that's why I think, you know, I've seen so many non-traditional students at SU in their grad programs.
Yeah.
So, yeah, and, yeah, that would work out for the athletes as well. If they're able to get into
right.
the grad program, then, yeah, SU's an option for them.
And I think that brings up a larger discussion, and is how is that rule of grad transferring fair? It rewards programs that don't have really competitive grad schools. So that doesn't seem to be right. You want major universities, whether they be public or private, to excel and to have the most competitive grad schools as possible, I suppose. I mean, doesn't that seem like a thing you'd want to encourage as opposed to having grad programs that are easy to get in? It's kind of weird. I don't think necessarily this is a wrap on Seattle U or Gonzaga or anybody else who's had a lot of grad transfers, but I just think it's kind of a weird rule. But the news here today is that Jim Hayford has been able to figure out a way, regardless to what the facts are about CLU's grad programs, and work it to his advantage. So that's the good news for CLU fans. And so that's cool.
And
so that's the rule.
Easy to get it. Yeah. I mean, I don't want to say
what's
easy to get. Like, it's not easy to get into grad school, but yeah, it might be easier or, you know, less.
Easier, yeah.
Less competition.
For me, it'd be impossible, but that's another story. So aside from that, like, we got a couple more minutes left on our segment here on CLU. What have you seen just in the team that you thought has been the most remarkable this whole non-conference season?
Well, you know, the thing going into the season, you know, that, you know, Hayford talked about, and, you know, anyone who kind of been paying attention to Eastern Washington over the last few years expected was, you know, they were going to score more, they were going to shoot more, they're going to shoot a lot of threes. And if you just look at the numbers so far, comparing to last season's team, you know, the last season under Cameron Dollar, they are scoring a lot more. They're averaging like 82 points a game this year. Last year they averaged 69 points a game, but they're not shooting that much more. And in fact, they're only shooting one more three-pointer per game. Last season they were shooting 25 threes a game, and this season it's 26. And their percentage is better. They're shooting, I think, 39% this year, and I think last year it was like 33%. And then just overall field goals, they're shooting at just like five more per game than last season. So, and the defense, which, you know, some might have worried, okay, well, that was, you know, Cameron Dollar's team's thing was, you know, a defensive rebounding team. Hasn't been that much different. I mean, last season they gave up 71 points a game, and this season it's 74. So, and then, if, you know, I'm looking at the, you know, assists and turnovers and, you know, rebounds and other stats like that. It's pretty much the same, you know, with slight differences between last year and this year. So it's like numbers-wise, except for the scoring, you know, it's like they're not – it's not like wildly different, you know, stats-wise. Now, style of play, if you watch them, I mean, yeah, it's a different team. You know, it's a different style. So that was just interesting to me when I looked up the stats. I was kind of surprised, like, oh, okay, they're not shooting a lot more threes. You know, they're making more, but they're not, you know, shooting a lot more. It's like they're not,
it wasn't this drastic, you know, oh, now it's just a run and gun type of thing, which I guess could be expected because, you know, it's Hayford's first year and he has a lot of players that were there last year. So, I mean, you know, you still have to kind of, you know, play to your strengths and everything.
Well, the number I'm seeing that really jumps out at me is Kavis 50% from three. I mean, on 106 attempts. Jordan Hill 45% from three on 92 attempts. I mean, Herlihy 43% from three. You know, these guys are shooting really well from three. You know, Gittens has been the one guy that's sort of disappointed. He's only shooting 29%, but you know, and Means has also had kind of disappointing season shooting from distance, but he's been pretty good otherwise. And Nettles has been a decent shooter. But the thing is, those top three, you know, all three of, well, you know, Kavis and then the two grad transfers. I mean, that's some pretty good production from three when you're really a team that really focuses on 3-point shooting. So right now they're shooting well. I guess that's what we need to talk. We need to kind of move ahead. I've got a Frank Burleson getting ready to talk about the LA scene and stuff like that. I really appreciate you coming on, Amar, and we'll come back here and again. There's so much to talk about with Seattle. It's really exciting. We'd like to have you on as soon as possible again.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks for having me on. And you know, if you guys check out the.
Oh man, Frank, is that you?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I just hung up on Amar from Seattle U analyst, and I just hung up, put the wrong button, hung up on him. He's ready to talk about his website. So just to let everybody know, he's got it. He will live. Exactly. He's a great guy, and he's been a consistent supporter of the show. But he just to let everybody know about his website, he's got a Facebook page on Seattle U Basketball that's the best place to go for what's going on. He does a really good constant stream of news and involving old Seattle U, new Seattle U women's, recruiting, the whole nine yards.
Has
so definitely go
about
to Facebook.
DeJuan Oldham or Clint Richardson?
Oh yeah, he's had stuff about the old guys. He's had things here and there, and he's been doing a really good job. You know, he's not really as up on that. He's much younger than I. I would definitely focus on polo scores. I remember seeing Juwan Oldham in eighth grade, and my junior high school played the junior high school that was probably the most dominant junior high school team in the history of Seattle. They had like Juwan Oldham, Clint Richardson, but just a whole, no, maybe it was, who are the guys on that team? I can't remember, but they had like four or five guys that went D1.
Carl Irvin.
It was Asa Mercer Junior High School. High School. And one of the guys went to Garfield and had a big career there, and then it went to UW. One of the guys, the other guys ended up at either Cleveland or Franklin or Beach. It was just an incredible incredible team. They just completely killed us. But so there's that story, and you probably even remember that, which is the main thing about your career. We talked quite a bit about your beginnings, but I want to make sure everybody knows what you did in your career of just basically being the first guy to really cover recruiting, both football and basketball, kind of as a local beat reporter on the West Coast. And, you know, you really got it off the ground and really took things to, you know, the point where it's now become a cottage industry, you know, all over the place. But getting on to what really is going on right now is Washington State going down to California. Did you get a chance to see either of those games against USC and UCLA for either of the Huskers?
No, I didn't go because I was at the Classic at Damien 64 high school tournament in Laverne, where Damien's actually where Bill Duffy went to high school and the McGuires and stuff. So I was there and all week. So I didn't. I was in the gym from basically 7:30 in the morning to 11:30 at night. So I didn't see any game. But again, Washington. I mean, they've proven they can play very well on the road. Going into Lawrence, Kansas, and winning, and then going into Poly Pavilion and leading for what was it, three, you know, winning in the Galen Center, of course. I slipped that one, but then going into Poly Pavilion and, you know, in what, three quarters of the game, they were up or tied until, you know, that incredible run that kind of distorted the final score and didn't really account for what kind of competitive game. So that didn't spike. And, you know, and again, I'm jumping ahead of your question. I mean, I think when you look at the Pac-12 this season, you know, Arizona State, Arizona, you know, what does that game prove? Well, it proves that, you know, I think as much as anything, including a win in Lawrence, Kansas, which in hindsight maybe isn't quite as significant as we thought it was, you know, post-Washington.
Agreed.
And Kansas is definitely not like Kentucky. Kentucky's a vastly, vastly, vastly overrated team.
Right.
You know, it's proven by the fact that UCLA beat them on, you know, not really a neutral court, because anything outside of a team's home arena is never going to be a neutral court against Kentucky. But again,
right.
I think, you know, history, you know, the next 2 months will prove the exact dynamics of the Pac-12. But I think for the most part, nothing's going to surprise me in the conference this year, with a couple exceptions. I think this is as balanced a Pac-12 as we've seen in a while.
True.
And then again, as of now, I don't think it's a particularly strong Pac-12 relative to some of the ones we've seen. And again, I think we still have to point to, even with that disastrous 0-3 record Thanksgiving weekend they had out in the islands, which of our islands happened to be, again, November might as well have been 10 years ago the way I'm thinking right now. But again, I think Arizona still, anytime you got a DeAndre Ayton and, you know, the guys they've got back who've been part of it, they're still the favorite. But again, I just think it's, wow. I think it's going to be so critical for teams to, you know, somehow fight their way to 12 conference wins and win a couple key ones on the road to even be in contention for, you know, for an NCAA tournament bid. But again, it's going to make for entertaining basketball, you know, night in and night out.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think, you know, it's interesting. I mean, there's been some real interesting teams. I mean, I'm really actually very curious to see what happens in the Big Sky Conference. I mean, Portland State, they beat Cal and beat them just like a drum. I mean, that's a team that you really got to keep an eye on. They could be really fun to watch. And that, and just the Big Sky with you know, with Montana, with Travis DeCuir and Eastern and Idaho, which is really a veteran team that's really got a lot of dynamic players. And there's a really there's, of course,
Victor
Weber State,
Sanders,
the power.
Again,
and Victor Sanders and Kieron Collin-Durrett,
I think across the board in the West, I think, remember when St. Mary's stumbled to Washington State and the third place game, Georgia, where people, St. Mary's and Gonzaga, you know, beat Tennessee or whoever it was, and they almost, almost beat Florida, and everybody's jumping on. Well, in hindsight, you know, I think as we get into conference play, and I'm not sure when they meet, but we may still find that St. Mary's, like everybody thought, was the team to beat in the WCC this year, based upon, you know, all the quality veterans they had back.
Well, a conference that I really like to watch, and I haven't really been able to because I've been so busy with other stuff with Big Sky and Pac-12, and I'm sure you get a better chance to see them, is the Big West. So what's going on with the Big West so far?
You know, the Big West is, you know, this is an interesting conference. You know, you think back that it wasn't so many years ago. I mean, in hindsight, you know, almost 30, but, you know, in the days of UNLV when they were very good, when Long Beach State had a team, with Seth Greenberg's team with Brian Russell and Lucius Harris and the great Utah State teams, very, very good. I mean, this was a very, very, you know, and back in the days when they were the Pacific Coast Athletic Association, PCAA. Again, it's not that conference anymore. It's not even close to that conference anymore. And what you do is you happen to have, in any particular year, one team might have, you know, a group of veterans, a la Irvine a couple of years ago, a couple of good transfers, a la, you know, a la Santa Barbara this year. You see Santa Barbara team with Joe Pastrnak, which is right now looking like the class of the conference. So again, it's competitive games. It's just not what people like you and I remember from the 80s and a big hunk of the 90s. But again, It is one of the multitude of conferences now that in reality, no matter what happens during the regular season, it's going to come down to what happens in 3 days in March, in this case, you know, in Anaheim for the Big West.
Yeah, that's pretty much it, and that's what it is in the Big Sky. They never had an at-large bid or anything like that. And for that matter, the WAC has become that kind of a league too. It's they're all one bid leagues, but they're interesting to watch. But you know, getting back to the Pac-12, I was looking back at some of the stuff that was said, you know, maybe a little while ago before Michael Porter had his back surgery and all that stuff, and you more or less said that he was hands down the top player in the class of 2017,
oh, yeah.
And of course now everyone's talking about Ayton, and people are saying that. I've heard people talking about Porter's a bust and this and that. I think he's got a huge ceiling, and it's just I think he's got a lot that he's going to be able to show in the NBA once he gets things rolling, if everything goes well. What do you think about the prospects of him playing this year? What have you heard about that, Michael Porter?
Well, I mean, I haven't talked to anybody at Missouri about it or anybody with the family about it. I've heard, oh, he's going to try. I think that was, here again, who am I to say what a family should do or what kind of decisions a family or a kid should make? But again, I think when you look at what happened with Harry Giles, he's still mm-hmm. not been cleared to play. They rolled the dice with his knee surgery. This is what, three different knee surgeries he's had, two of ACLs mm-hmm. and MCL and on. And Sacramento rolled the dice. I mean, it's, you know, at 20 something, yeah. You know, it's a right as of now, it's, you know, it's too late to say it's a bust, but you don't know. But again, I think people who are perceived to be damaged goods, players, mm-hmm. I mean, that's such an investment to make. Forget, you know, let's just talk about a first-round pick, multitude of committed dollars you get to pay in that guy and the money you invest in scouting and making decisions, and then ultimately what it could cost, directly a general manager and the scouting staff and indirectly a coach. With mm-hmm. too many bad decisions. And again, if Michael Porter comes back and tries to play, and he is not he isn't physically 95-96% ready to play, or if he tries to just say, okay, I'm going to work out and have surgery and improve, you know what? He's going to, from my perception, he's going to have to, you know, totally rehabilitate the injury and, you know, based on the surgery and everything, and show that he is not only, okay, he's healthy, have the doctor sign off he's healthy. He's going to have to get on the court and show people again what he's capable of doing when he's healthy. Again, unless he's willing to be a 20 to 30 pick or 25 pick, he's still going to player to be picked that low. You know what I mean?
I think it'll be a top 5 to 7 pick if he doesn't play another game this year. That's my gut feeling.
No chance. No chance.
You don't think that'll happen?
Zero chance. We're talking back
really?
Surgery, brother. No way.
Okay, well, that's
no
what
way.
I want to know from you. What is it? Tell me what it is. What it is that you know about the surgery, and what is the prognosis?
Well, I mean, anytime you say spine and that's out there, either people are going to be so leery. I mean, people don't want to, again, it's not just, okay, we didn't get a big pick. You lose jobs over stuff like this. And again,
sure.
At the very least, get healthy. You're healthy. Get on the court, play with your brother another year, have a great season, go deep in the tournament, build your stock.
Right.
Hey, and maybe 2019, you're number one, you're the first pick, you know?
Right.
The thing is, I
have no idea how serious his injury is. So that's all I'm hearing. I don't think there's really been much definitive information as far as how serious it really is. So I'm thinking if it's a minor thing, and I know back surgery is a scary thing. Back injuries are a scary deal for sure for anybody.
Back surgery, a minor back surgery is like minor heart surgery. It's what happens to somebody else, you know.
Right, minor brain surgery, exactly. Yeah, it's just
I can think of a few politicians today that any brain surgery would be minor surgery. If you know what I mean,
Unfortunately, there's more than a couple. It's like maybe a couple 5,000 of them right now, and it's really bad, man. I'm telling you, it's as bad as it. I can't even imagine of it being a worse time. To feel like what the hell is going on, you know?
But again, we, you know, this is a basketball discussion here. But let's tell you this, and I'll leave it at this, and we can move on to basketball, you know, proper.
Okay.
you know, you love music, you love hoops, you love everything that's good about, you know, entertainment, about creativity,
about
the positive things we see, you know, people working to help other people. And I wake up every day, get jazzed about watching basketball and talking basketball and seeing movies and things like that. And I think to myself in the back of my mind,
love movies.
This could all be over. You know, this could.
I know. It's a dangerous time.
And I think anybody who doesn't grasp how dangerous this time is on so many levels.
I think this is all encapsulated here. Okay, I believe this a year ago when the story had just come out, you know, and it was just being pushed around mostly kind of on the fringes. But I believe that the Trump campaign worked and accepted the help and probably even aided the Russians in messing around with the election, which to me is an incredible thing to just behold. And how anybody would tolerate that and think that's okay just because they won and because they're a Republican, they want to have political power, and if it's okay, oh yeah, whatever, you know, hey, the people, they won, so you know. That, to me, that's just disgusting. And to think that is one of only six or seven really scary things that are going on that they've done, and one which people actually care about maybe less than all or most of the others. I mean, that's just terrifying. You got the atomic, you know, the nuclear bomb. You got this, the whole thing of just this payola and this, you know, people paying for access to him and his family and stuff. It's just the whole thing just on and on, you know, the disrespect for the rule of law, bad rapping all of our law enforcement, bad rapping all the foreign service people, just on and on. It's just so much stuff right now. It's I can't take it. You know,
it's overwhelming. It can overwhelm me again. And the thing is, and people just say, well, you know, people tell me all the time, family members and basketball coaches, and they say, well, you can't do anything about it, so why let it ruin your life? Or why let it bother you, you know, impact your daily life? That's why I care about more than just, you know, paying bills or being able to do what we can afford to do and watching great basketball or going to the movies or so, you know, and, you know, I care about, and I think you do, and I think all like-minded people who appreciate what we've experienced for the most part growing up, and that in theory what democracy means, and in theory what this country, because obviously we could point to 10, 12, 13 different things throughout the course of the United States that certainly counter what this country supposedly was built upon and what the Constitution was constructed for. Be it slavery, be it, you know, be it the Trail of Tears, the, you know, the what happened to Native Americans and Jim Crow laws and Japanese internment, all those kind of things. But again, what we want this country to be and what we hope it can be, it's teetering on the edge right now. And
it really is.
And people who can't grasp it, they're out of touch with reality.
Yeah, we're in really dangerous times, and so I appreciate you coming on here. And I think that if anybody wants to, you know, to know what's going on, just, you know, follow Frank and myself on Twitter. We touch on basketball a lot, but we also are doing a lot, just unfortunately, just this recent time frame on these topics. So if you want to know what's going on, you know, feel, not that we're the experts by any means, but we're both at least concerned people about this stuff. But getting back to the Pac-12 and what's going on with UW and stuff, and Wazoo, you know, Wazoo has impressed me a little bit. That Skaggs guy from Indiana has had some really good moments in non-conference. I wouldn't be surprised to see him be kind of a story in the Pac-12. And I think, you know, Franks has really shown, he's all of a sudden really come into his own, and that's a team, they're playing UW this week. That's a team that's, I think, you know, considered one of the bottom end teams in the league, but I think they may be better than that. Cal has shown that they're maybe better than being one of the bottom end teams. Stanford was thought to be a dark horse kind of candidate to maybe make a tournament spot this year, and they've kind of had sort of a rough row with kind of having some guys
out, but those guys are starting to come back. Pickens and Sheffield are coming back. And then, of course, Oregon State's kind of considered – they were horrible last year with all the injuries, but now they've got some guys back, and they seem like they have some potential. They, you know, they've done some – they beat Colorado, and, you know, so I think, you know, realistically, you know, there's some interesting teams in this Pac-12 from top to bottom. You know, they've been able to win the games they're supposed to win, which is great. You know, I just think they're just lacking in talent to the point where I just don't know that they won't be exposed as these very talented coaches that have greater depth and greater talent, sort of figure out a way to beat them with the zone and stuff. But, you know, what's your take on Washington right now?
I mean, you covered it. I mean, it's a lot of, you know, returning players who were better than their record, I think, last year than what the record indicated. You
agreed.
Know, obviously the addition of what's his name? Noel. Noel. The 6'5 guard whose father died. That's how I allude to things these days. Who is one of the very elite freshmen in the league. And again, a whole new system, obviously defensively, a whole new system. But you pointed out something, and I think it's going to impact not just Washington, which is why, you know, what happens in November, December is, you know, informative, if not totally educational in terms of what teams are going to be in February and late February and into March into the conference tournament. Is conference play is such a different dynamic than than even going into Lawrence, Kansas, or playing in a big, you know, tournament in Hawaii or the Virgin Islands or where it happens to be, one of these exempt things where you get 3 games in 3 days, because of the fact that once you get into conference, the coaches already have a strong, for the returning coaches, for the programs that have been intact for a while with the same coaches, you know, they've got an immense figurative and literal database of, you know, how that coach wants to play, how he does in certain every situation. You know, the players that return, they've got extensive books on those players. So I get that's why they say sometimes conference games, even if it's playing against a team with quote unquote less talent than some of the teams you play outside a conference or even into a tournament, postseason tournament, are much more difficult just because of familiarity and the scheming that goes on, scheming in a positive sense, in terms of, you know, scheming for a team to play in terms of game planning. It makes it so much difficult. Again, that's just not a Pac-12 dynamic. It's a dynamic through every conference that's happens with every conference. I mean, the classic example, what was it, the first ACC game or the second ACC game when Duke went into, you know, Boston College? You know, Boston College has a couple of good players and gets beat, you know, allows 89 points or whatever. It is because, you know, coaches within the conference know every nuance of what an opposing coach wants to do and plans for it, games plans for it. Whereas, you know, other coaches, I mean, I guarantee you the coaches, for the most part, will know a whole lot more about this Washington, not only in terms of the returning personnel, but how Coach Hopkins wants to play and his staff want to play with this team, will know way more about that when they play them starting with this past weekend than did Kansas, because again, you know, in November and December non-conference games, you prep. I mean, you have a lower level assistant who does some groundwork in terms of film editing and video editing and things like that and preparing game somewhat, you know, tentative game plans, but in terms of actual real game preparation, you don't do a lot. So that's why conference games probably as much in basketball or more than any other sport, conference games are so much difficult to play than even, you know, you think UCLA is going to have a lot tougher scoring going into Tucson or Oregon or any place than they did playing Kentucky on a neutral court. Absolutely. You know, absolutely.
Yeah. And then the other thing about the conference is it's just good. I mean, you know, you mentioned earlier in the conversation, you think the Pac-12 is down. Well, you know, I agree there, Well, look, you look at the NBA right now. How many guys are proving to be good NBA players that come from this league? It's just year after year, even in down years, you've got guys who are going to end up being real stories down the road as pros. You've got coaches who have had tremendous success and really come from great backgrounds. I mean, Larry Krystowiak, I mean, you've got a hand guy going in there beating Oregon. I mean, and I always talk about him, this is his rebuilding year. It has to be his down year. And he just keeps doing it year after year for those guys.
Well,
you know,
again,
it's just,
you talk about, in terms of the NBA, everybody talks about, you know, the players who go to the NBA and lose it. But, again, you know, when you've got Larry Krystowiak, great NBA background. You know, you've got guys like Cal Altman, who I guarantee you there is no more respected coach in all of college basketball right now than that guy. And again, you look at, you know, Ernie Kent has had some down years, but certainly here's a guy.
Been around.
I think he did it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, what he did at St. Mary's and Oregon and all those. What did we have? 2-3 Elite Eights at
two
at
Elite
Oregon.
Eights.
Yeah, this is, you know, and again, you know, you've got Andy and Phil at SC went to Sweet 16s at in Florida and won a couple of games in the NCAA tournament last year. And Alford's had rapidly approaching Steve Lavin's record for Sweet 16s. You know, so this is a tough conference. And again, when I say down, I mean relative to years where, four teams get to the Sweet 16 or a couple might get to the Elite Eight, which certainly was what the conference looked like last year going into the tournament.
Right. You know, I did a little look-see through just some of these leagues and stuff like that. I mean, there have been more guys, more first-round draft picks in the NBA draft out of the Pac-12. You know, in comparison to some of these other leagues, it's funny because I hear – analysts, many of whom have since moved on to other things, but talk about how the WCC is better than the Pac-12 this year, or the Pac-10 or whatever, the Mountain West is better. You know, the Pac-12 is just. Look at DeMar DeRozan, 52 points last night. I mean, there's just so much talent that comes into this league year after year after year, and guys like, for instance, Tyrone Wallace at Cal. You know, he struggled for a few years in minor leagues. Now he's got a shot at the NBA, and I mean, there's just a lot of great talent, and it's just hard to beat these teams week in, week out, night in, night out. Even a good team is going to have five good games and one bad one. You know, even a good team is going to do that, and you just get the right team playing a good game. And I think that a lot of people in Seattle are really excited about UW. I think that might have happened against USC, or this might be a team that might be able to. I mean, it sure hasn't shown statistically. Dominic Green has not been shooting 6 of 7 from the field all the year, but they do have some talent. But do you think this Washington team is a team that can really, really change the way that they've looked statistically over the course of this Pac-12 season, as opposed to a lot of teams really come down a few notches during conference play?
Well, again, when you're talking about, one weekend, one set of games, it's kind of hard to use that as a real litmus test for how a conference, cause again, you got to factor in injuries. You got to, there's no better look of what the Pac-12 release or any conference is than the second time around. Cause now you've already actually got a game under your belts to kind of build upon. So, I think right now, other than Arizona with, a guy that's going to be, one, two or three in the draft, probably, it's dollars to donuts. If you had to bet, you'd say he's probably got the best shot at going number one,
now.
If not Bagley, you're looking at teams that I think on any given, again, Utah. I mean, Utah goes in, wins a couple of games and on the road. So it's going to be an interesting, and I think it makes for, you go into the tournament in Las Vegas and you're going to be looking at teams that, may need a couple of wins in the tournament just to solidify or put themselves in position to get to that large bid. So, which I think, is going to make for as dynamic and precarious in terms of what's on the lines for teams, the Pac-12 tournament, as we've seen in a while.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I also, you didn't even mention your hometown UCLA Bruins, who, got a sweep this weekend in impressive fashion, and I think have really definitely have the pieces, the puzzle pieces together to be one of the top four teams and again get in the NCAA tournament, and who knows what they can do once they get there. And then
again, we talked about UCLA. You know, they did it. You know, they beat an overrated Kentucky team, quote unquote.
True.
You know, back east, not a neutral court because it's never a neutral court against Kentucky based on fan bases. But again, it's a team that I want to see what they do on the road. You know, other than the Kentucky win. You know, the tough teams they met away from Pauley Pavilion, for the most part, they lost to. So, and then they had that horrific game against, again, classic, I don't know how good Michigan is, and, they fell apart.
Right.
So, again, I think UCLA does have a chance to be a tournament team, and I think the aesthetics of the Kentucky, come March, let's see how really impressive that Kentucky. Now, if Kentucky goes ahead and wins the Southeastern Conference in impressive fashion and does all that, then obviously it can be like, but if Kentucky stumbles and loses 3, 4, 5 times in the Southeastern Conference, which wouldn't shock me. I mean, they barely beat Georgia at home last night. They barely beaten a lot of so-so teams. So, again, UCLA should be an NCAA tournament, but again, a lot of teams should be, and they don't end up. So it'll be interesting. I think what we've seen with this UCLA team is, just really how critical with what we've seen with this UCLA team, and then how little TJ Leaf is playing now, and the fact that EK Enigbogo is not playing at all, we're seeing really the dynamics of what Lonzo Ball brought to that program in his season. Yeah.
And he's really getting it done. I mean, we're running out of time here, but we could talk all day, Frank. You know that. But the key thing is with UCLA, truthfully, I'm a little bit more bullish on what they're doing. I think they've got something enough going this year where I think they'll probably squeeze into the tournament. I think Arizona, for aside from that one blip on the screen in November, I think is definitely a team that could contend for a national championship or a Final Four berth. And I think you cannot forget Oregon. They did lose to Utah this weekend. They had sort of a couple of disappointments. But I'm looking at the long picture, the big picture. He's got those grad transfers. He's got those 5-star freshmen. He's got Peyton Pritchard. He's got some good players. He's got enough. And you give that guy enough, he can get a lot done week in, week out in this conference.
I think he's going to be there probably.
Utah looks like they're going to be there. USC, it's kind of hard to know. I mean, if he can't get
USC
that together, you got to wonder. He's really got talent this year. I don't know if he can get
it
together this year. I don't know. He did last year.
It's an interesting dynamic. There was times last year they weren't particularly good, and they had to close strong to get in the tournament. Again, this whole Anthony Melton with the federal investigation stuff, and with every day it's looking more and more like he's never going to play for them, and that was huge. Mm-hmm. I mean, he is a very, very good player in a lot of different fashions. And then, with the Metu stuff, that wasn't a good look. You mentioned the gags. I hope he's walking. I hope he's walking comfortably these days. So, really, it's an interesting dynamic. And again, I think it's going to make for, other than Arizona, which is what kind of people thought going in, it's almost anything could happen. I mean, who would have thought 3 months ago that we'd be talking about Arizona being ranked number 4 in the country or 3 or whatever they are now? I mean, it's amazing.
Yeah. Well, it just goes back and forth. I mean, the key thing is, I think you really hit on when we're talking about UCLA, John Wooden, bless his heart, rest his soul, is gone, and he hasn't even coached for 40 years. And so teams are not going to be undefeated in the Pac-12 and all that. I mean, in the Pac-12, if Arizona gets a split on every single one of their road weekends and wins, every single one of their home games, they're going to be the champion of this conference, and everyone's going to be talking about them as being a dominant team. It's not like teams are going to win every single game, but there's going to be – Arizona's going to lose games. I can guarantee it now.
I don't think this is an Arizona team that's going to go 16-0 or whatever they, 16-2 or whatever. But again, it's just right now when you look at them, they probably have the fewest questions. If they remain healthy, they have the fewest questions. You get a veteran point guard. You've got, you know, Trier and Raleigh Alcorn are gifted and are experienced. Certainly Ayton, talent-wise, is on a different relative to his size, is on a different level than anyone in the conference this year. So they're the one team where you could say, okay, you know, are they going to slip up and lose a couple of games? Yeah. Are they going to lose 5-6? No. So it's going to be very hard, I think, to envision. It's hard to envision anyone finishing ahead of them in the conference standing.
Well, it seems like it now, but then again, a few months ago, people were talking about Arizona being really a disappointment this year. So it's hard to know. I mean, again, there's Utah, there's Oregon, there's really, truthfully, you know, Arizona State has put on some really good shows. It's hard, you know. I know they lost, but they lost a very close game to Arizona, and it was on the road too. So I don't know if we can really write them out of the title picture quite yet. It seems like they shouldn't be, but it always seemed like they shouldn't be this year, and they just keep on putting on amazing efforts. I mean, Trey Holder has been really productive, and that whole team is dynamic.
Well,
you saw Remy Martin coming up the whole time he was coming up, and did you think of a college career for him?
I mean, he's so fast. His trouble in the high school level was he couldn't govern his speed at times. A lot of times in the big games, be it against Sierra Canyon last season, against Bishop Montgomery last season in the Southern Section Open Division semifinals at the Galen Center, and then, you know, in the first round of the state playoffs when St. Augustine of San Diego upset them, and key elements of his junior when they played the Alonzo Ball and the Chino Hills team in the championship game. I mean,
right.
But again, in terms of speed, and he can shoot it, and he's dynamic. Oh, he's got it all. You know, Coach Hurley appears to be doing such. If they can stabilize him and tell him teach him to play at different speeds and to pick and choose to turn on the afterburners, he's going to be a heck of a player. And so far, he's kind of proven that right.
Well, you know, I think we need to end it on a comedic note, although it may not be that comedic. Orrin Hatch is going to retire, so hopefully we can put his memory down the line.
Good.
He can go help Larry Krystkowiak with raise some money for Utah basketball or something.
Well, I think Larry's got more solid moral base than to allow somebody like that to help his basketball program.
I'm just kidding, totally. You know that, Frank. You know, I make jokes that people think that I'm serious, but I'm very sarcastic. I'm so sorry about that. Anyway, buddy, it's great talking to
you. You know, sometimes sarcasm is a good way to escape the reality of what's going on.
Oh Lord, it's just unbelievable. I mean, let me just tell you, this whole idea of these guys talking about the Black Confederate. I mean, we're living in a really, really weird time, you know, just a weird time.
Yeah, again, it's you and I both, you know, again, we know how each other's aligned politically and socially. So we both were fearful of what could happen if what happened in November 2016 happened. But this totally exceeded, it has exceeded in actual what's happened. And I think the saddest thing, and we could call it the saddest thing, is that, you know, some of these people, some of these politicians, not just Trump, but any of them, you know what their motives are. You understand what they're doing, and they have their own reasoning, and by their reasoning, okay, I get what you're doing. But if there's so many people who are being hurt now and are going to be hurt who supported it and continue to support it, I don't get it. You know,
but it really has defined, I mean, I can't even believe that Republicans who for years and years were the people just, you know, trumpeting this whole anti-Russia thing, and they're just I mean, so much hypocrisy when it benefits them. There's just no end to what people will do to pivot to accept things as long as it benefits them. And that's, to me, that's been the most disappointing thing about it. I thought they'd be more principled Republicans, and I'm very, very disappointed it hasn't happened.
I think, unfortunately, you know, and that was not always been the case, but principled Republicans is going to be one of the key oxymorons of our generation.
Yeah, I think so. The principal should have been the principals we had when I was a little kid when they had the paddle at the principal's office. That's the principal for Republicans, I think, at this point. Anyway, well, I'll tell you what, we got to call it a day, but it's all, as usual, tremendous fun talking to you, Frank, and thanks so much for coming on the show.
My pleasure, Jim. Keep up the good work, buddy.
Thank you, sir. You absolutely, yourself too. All right.
Okay,
for Frank Burleson, Amar Abdul Nazir, this is Jim Bassnight for Talking Hoops. As Bob Robertson would say, always be a good sport. Be a good sport always. We'll see you next time. See you next week.